music of Mozart was used in an episode of the hit TV series Mad Men, and it sets the tone for us here. Don't fool yourself. This is some very dirty business, Madison Avenue executive Roger Sterling's admonition to his younger colleague, Pete Campbell, comes on the heels of a decision to ask office manager Joan Holloway to prostitute herself in order to win a coveted account with the British automaker Jaguar. Although Sterling's words ostensibly condemn Campbell's plan, the ad exec's actions tell a different story. Immediately prior to his comment, Sterling has acquiesced, along with the other partners in the room, to the dirty business Campbell proposes. Furthermore, it is Sterling who prevents any further protest or change of plans, lodging his apparent complaint as he stands up to leave Campbell and partner Lane Price behind to make the arrangements. In light of these actions, Sterling's comment seems less like a condemnation and more like a cynical acceptance of the amoral, even immoral, nature of corporate survival. This is some very dirty business, and he implies there is no avoiding dirty hands. Don't fool yourself, he says. Business opposes, even precludes, the other-oriented moral point of view. To anyone familiar with Roger Sterling's perspective, business ethics may seem a dubious notion, if not a contradiction in terms. To anyone familiar with the AMC television series, an essay on business ethics in Mad Men may seem doubly dubious. Best known for the worst tendencies of corporate America, Matthew Weiner's series seems, at first glance, incapable of cultivating ethical business practices. Upon closer investigation, however, Mad Men's serial narrative may be uncommonly well-suited to business ethics. The series is, admittedly, no treatise on advertising ethics. What it offers, though, may be more valuable than a treatise. It serially dramatizes the thoroughly human beings at the heart of business and ethics alike. With its attention to these thoroughly realistic human subjects, this essay highlights questions the series raises as a series, questions about the discernibility and value of truth and sincerity, and the mutable, even malleable quality of desire, personal identity, and moral character. That from Howard Pickett and an essay titled It's the Real Thing, Identity and Sincerity in Mad Men. If, as Pickett argues, the hit TV series Mad Men raises questions about truth and sincerity in the context of business ethics and moral character in a story set in the 1960s, we can travel back 100 years and more, and we will meet, perhaps to our surprise, the very same terms, truth, sincerity, and moral character. In her new study, Branding Trust, Dr. Jennifer Black writes, gentility and character as defining elements of American culture shaped commercial developments in the built environment as new urban shopping districts emerged in the 1840s. These shopping districts were cleaner, brighter, and more elegant than ever before, featuring buildings with new architectural forms and interior designs that projected an air of respectability. The artisanal workspaces that had been so visible in colonial shops moved to back rooms, making way for new merchandise showrooms that separated manual work from non-manual work, production from consumption. Such changes were necessary to draw middle-class consumers back to downtown spaces where rapid industrialization in the first decades of the century had precipitated vice and crime. In an 1856 engraving of Daniel Appleton's New York City bookstore offers an illustrative example of these merchandising strategies. The store's well-lit interiors featured Grecian columns, marble busts, and tall, elegant bookcases rendered in the popular neoclassical style of the day. Well-dressed white men and women browsed through the shop, their middle-class status clearly visible in their clean, fashionable appearances. Adopting appropriate fashions and furnishings for one's retail space and mirroring propriety in written communication would demonstrate a merchant's character in much the same way that other individuals did in dress and speech. Such demonstrations became a central component of developing advertising strategies in the antebellum period. These, in turn, provided a foundation for advertisers' later attempts to both understand their audiences and appeal to those audiences in print. In these ways, the business community relied upon middle-class codes of conduct to evaluate trustworthiness in the antebellum United States, using the rubric of character to assess acceptable commercial behavior, credit risks, financial stability, and investment opportunities. In their written interactions with each other and with the public, merchants adopted many familiar strategies to demonstrate propriety and trustworthiness. They used language codes to show their manners and education. They modeled humility and transparency to build reputation, and they evidenced character by showcasing their faith in individual virtue, by avoiding vice, and by repaying debts promptly. Such strategies eventually became habits that would persist in the advertising industry as it developed through the 19th century, with a continued emphasis on gaining consumers' trust. Words from a new study titled Branding Trust, Advertising and Trademarks in 19th Century America by Jennifer Black, issued by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Dr. Black is an associate professor of history and government at Misericordia University in Dallas, Pennsylvania, and she will present an author's talk with a book signing this Thursday, April 25th, at the Pauli Friedman Art Gallery, where an exhibition titled The Mark, Graphic Design and Consumer Culture Since 1800, will be on display through May 11th. Dr. Black paid a visit to the WVIA studios to talk with us about her study and her interest in the 19th century.
As an academic, a lot of historians, my colleagues at Misericordia, have stories about reading Johnny Tremaine as a child, or, you know, an encaptivating lecturer that they had in college or something. And I would like to say that I always wanted to be a historian, but that was not my case whatsoever. I went to Western Michigan University straight after high school, and I was a musical theater performance major. And then I switched to what I thought was a much more sensible degree of art history. But, you know, really, art history opened so many doors for me intellectually that I do have stories about, you know, top professors who saw something in me and who believed in me. One professor who hired me as a research assistant. And I had a professor who was a specialist in Nepalese and Tibetan and Buddhist art. And I was just fascinated by the iconography of it, the symbols, you know, every little hand gesture, every pin curl on the head of the Buddha or the Bodhisattvas had meaning, and that these meanings changed over time as the artists developed their craft and as different sects of Buddhism emerged and different aspects of the practice shifted or changed, that I was just sort of enamored by it. Growing up as an Irish Catholic in Detroit, I had no exposure to Buddhism. And that's not anything against my upbringing. I just wasn't aware. And so this opened so many doors intellectually for me, to philosophy, to religion, to symbolism and icons. And I think in a roundabout way, I ended where I've started. I'm back to where I began, because I got into art history because I was really interested in the icons and in the symbolism. And now I write about trademarks. But, you know, in the middle, I went to a museum studies program in public history at Western Michigan. And then I went to get my PhD at the University of Southern California, where I studied with a very, very strong and brilliant scholar named Vanessa Schwartz, who's also very interested in visual culture. And what drew me to her is that she had written a book on 19th century Paris. And in the book, there was a chapter on the morgue. And people in Paris in the 19th century went to the morgue on Sunday afternoons for entertainment. Because the morgue would take the unidentified bodies and they would set them up in little tableau vivant. And so people would walk through and walk past the displays in the morgue. And it became a form of entertainment. And I thought, this is so weird. You know, 19th century people are so wacky and so strange. And it made me want to know more about them.
Happily, the only morgue we might think of as we read your book is picturing you doing research in the files of newspaper morgues. But that being said, you give us quite an experience of 19th century Americans, and you might have started with the Gilded Age, but how did you know that you had to turn back the pages to the early 1800s?
Yeah, actually, that's a great question, because I did start in the Gilded Age to begin with. So this book, Branding Trust, Advertising and Trademarks in 19th Century America, it began with my dissertation at the University of Southern California. And at first, I was studying 20th century advertising and film in the film industry. I was in Los Angeles, right? So when in Rome. And I took a course with Deborah Harkness, and she helped me come up with the title for this book when I was still writing my dissertation. But I did start in the Gilded Age in the 1870s, immediately following the Civil War, because that's where most of the literature was, most of the existing scholarship on advertising. And in the dissertation, I found that I had to sort of argue around certain things, because the themes that I was seeing in terms of sincerity and this importance of honor and character, a person's character, were cultural themes that historians had argued were no longer relevant, or at least not as persistent in the latter 19th century as they had been earlier. So I'm kind of arguing around these ideas. And I went to the Business History Conference, which is a gathering, it's a professional organization of historians and people who study business history. And they loved what I was doing. And up until that point, I don't think I had ever felt like I found my people in academia. And, you know, that's an important thing to find, right? And these were scholars who were really interested in what I was doing. And it was really getting myself into that intellectual community that pushed me to think, well, really, I should be looking at the earlier 19th century. And so I started by doing a lot of reading. I finished my dissertation in 2013. I went to my first business history conference that spring after I had already filed my dissertation. And I thought, you know, I really need to be reading a lot more in this literature of the early 19th century. And it was because one of those scholars had said to me, there's a deeper history here and you need to go find it. So I went looking for a footnote and it kind of sent me down a rabbit hole, but it was a good rabbit hole. And so I read and I read and I read. And yeah, what I learned was that these developments in terms of branding and trademarks, they're much earlier than we think.
Certain of those terms might surprise us. In trying to get their wares out there and have people buy them, there were moral considerations, sincerity, character.
Yeah, and that really comes out of the context of the early 19th century. As the United States starts to industrialize after the War of 1812, you have the growth of cities. And some historians will call this the market revolution. It's the industrialization of the United States, first with the textile industry in New England, and then later in other regions. But as that industrialization is taking place, we have massive influx of immigration in the early 19th century, the 1820s, 1830s. We have new technological advances with the advent of steam press and steam engines, steam energy, new transportation mechanisms, the steamboat, the railroad. These are all inventions of the early 19th century, 1830s or so. The Baltimore and Ohio Railroad is the first in the United States, and they're established in 1830. But canals had also provided a main thoroughfare of distribution that was very important for the United States. And so we start to see urbanization taking place and new technologies and new influx of people and factory systems developing. And as all of that is developing, markets are growing in the United States. And firms have always wanted to reach new markets. This is a constant. This isn't something that's new to the 1820s or 30s. Josiah Wedgwood wanted to reach new markets in the 1750s, the 1780s, with his beautiful chinawares and earthenwares. And he was building brands, by the way. And so we know this in certain sectors of history. Material culture people know it. People who study the Revolution know it. But consumer culture people were still focused on the Gilded Age. And so one of the things where this importance of character comes in is through the middle class. And the middle class is struggling to make their way. They're trying to differentiate themselves from working class immigrants and the lower rungs of society. But they also know that they're not elites quite. And for them, economic stability is rather tentative because a lot of the men are now entering wage jobs. So they're working white-collar professions, bankers, clerks, what we would call secretaries, although this is a male-dominated field at the time, managers, middle management. So they're not day laborers. They're not laborers in factories or farmhands, but they're also not the wealthy owners. And so as wage earners, they know that their economic livelihood can be rather tentative because they don't own vast amounts of land and property. They don't have those assets. And so the middle class develops these codes for displaying one's true self, one's true identity, because they were so afraid of fraud. There were so many possibilities to get scammed and to meet confidence men and to lose it all in the next economic bust. And by the way, the economy of the United States was rife with booms and busts in the first 75 years of its existence. So there were so many opportunities to lose it, to lose everything you had, that they had to be very careful about who they trusted in their business relationships. And all of that trust was built through relationships. It was built through personal contact, but it was also built on the letters and recommendations of friends or family members or other business partners. It was built on streams of credit. Is this person credit worthy? Do they have property? Do they have liquidable assets? Do they pay their bills on time? Are they morally upright? A person who was prone to vice did not usually get a good credit rating. And I know that we might think of that as sort of, you know, a disreputable way of doing business today. But in the 19th century, it was very common. You know, do they go to church? Do they drink? Do they gamble? And if the answers to those questions weren't the right answers, then you couldn't count on credit. So reputation was extraordinarily important to business success and overall economic livelihood in this time period. And that's where we get to the importance of trust and character.
There are early examples in which the images adopted by a company might personify the company itself in those terms.
Yeah. In the second half of the book, I look at strategies for visual representation, and I talk about Lydia Pinkham, who was the figurehead of the Lydia E. Pinkham Company. It was a medicinal producer out of Lynn, Massachusetts. And they produced primarily over-the-counter medicines, what historians would call patent medicines, for women. And these medicines were designed to cure anything from prolapsed uterus to menstrual cramps to, you know, hemorrhoids sometimes. I mean, so many, wide range of ailments. And we know today that some of these medicines were largely placebos in that they just contained alcohol or some other kind of narcotic. But the Lydia Pinkham Company was interesting because after Lydia's death in the early 1880s, they continued to use this grandmotherly figure of the old woman as the figurehead for the company. And they encouraged customers to write in to the company, and they would say, tell Lydia your troubles, right? A woman understands another woman like the male doctors don't. And so you see this sort of litany of testifiers coming forward, people who have used the medicines who say, I had doctored with many men and they never got it. They didn't understand me. But then I wrote to the Lydia Pinkham Company and they gave me the right solution. And so the Pinkham Company is really developing a cohort or an imagined community of women who are all consumers of the product, but who are kind of like each contributing to and gaining from the reputation of the company itself. And it's all through that sort of esteemed persona of Lydia Pinkham and the carefully crafted image of her, not just the visual image, but the sort of personality, the reputation of Lydia Pinkham, where that comes through.
You call them ad men, not mad men, like we know from the TV series, but those who are involved in creating advertising for sellers. What's their role in creating a campaign like the Lydia Pinkham effort?
So the Lydia Pinkham Company, as I mentioned, is one of the first to use their figureheads as a sort of model or fictional spokesperson, I might say, quasi-fictional for the company, because they use her long after her death in the 1880s. But by the 1890s or so, advertising agencies have really come into their own, starting from the first agency, which was established by Volney Palmer in the 1840s. 50 years later or so, we've got J. Walter Thompson, we've got George Batten, which is a precursor to BBDO, we've got the Charles Bates Agency, N.W. Ayer and Son, which is another major agency that lives long into the 20th century. These agencies get involved in creating fictional spokes characters like the Quaker Oatman or the child chef who is the spokesperson for Franco-American soups. Nabisco Crackers and Cookies also has a very early child spokesperson. And one of the things that I find really interesting, that I found interesting in this research, is that children were a very common type of spokes character. And I argue that that was for several reasons. Children sort of have this inherent innocence about them. They connote ideas of purity, of virtue, of sort of innocence, livelihood, health and wellness and play. And advertising professionals knew that in the 19th century. They played on the cultural ideas associated with childhood, and they used it to their advantage in crafting fictional spokespeople or spokescharacters that would appeal to consumers on various levels. So incorporating a child chef for Franco-American soups shows him sort of playfully holding the soup ladle or playfully holding the pot, and he smiles warmly at the viewer. He dips his finger in to taste the concoction that he's made, and he talks about the purity of the ingredients, the wholesomeness of the food. And so ipso facto, we have this association of purity and innocence that has been transferred from the fictional character to the product itself.
And in many of those images, there's a lot of text.
Oh, yeah. Yes. So there's a lot of text in the images. And one of the other storylines that I wanted to investigate in this book was, how do we get from this very orderly, narrow, fine point, classified advertisements in the newspaper, these very text-heavy advertisements, to the image-heavy regime that we associated with the 20th century? And so the ads that you referred to, I think the Franco-American Soup Boy, there is a lot of text in those. This is right around 1900, and this is when advertising agencies were still using what professionals would call a reason why kind of approach, where they're offering evidence, they're using persuasive language, they're telling stories, and they're trying to incorporate a bunch of ideas into the campaign and hope that those ideas are going to be sort of visually associated with the character or the logo. One of the things that I suggest happens by the early 20th century is that companies like the National Biscuit Corporation, which we know as Nabisco today, that they're able to successfully build these reputations and stories and evidence and all of the text from the advertising campaigns. They're able to build those ideas gradually over time so that by the 1910s, all you really need is the logo, because they've been repeating the logo and the stories over time for decades. And so by that point, the discourse, if you will, is so ingrained in the consumer's mind and in the public's memory associated with this visual symbol that all they need to do is reproduce the logo to communicate the same kind of messages.
We spoke briefly about the newspaper, the classifieds, but talk about the media, the way that advertisers got their messages across.
Yeah, so that's also really interesting because I think, again, in our modern day, we think about commercials on television, although who watches TV anymore? You can watch them online, right? Little ad banners. But in the 19th century, we're looking at a print media. And so there was the newspaper, but there was also billboards, what we would think of as billboards, or perhaps murals painted on the sides of buildings, or handbills, what we would call a flyer today, something that was more like 8.5 by 11 size, or perhaps 5 by 7 size, a piece of paper that somebody handed you on the street and that could get passed around. And those slips of paper, those handbills, might be inserted into books. They might be thrown into the package at your retail store. They grab one of them and toss it in. You know, it might be passed between people. Any number of reasons or methods a person could come across these handbills. And there were larger versions that we would call posters. They just called them bills at the time. And those would be pasted all over the city streets. In rural places, it was common for outdoor advertising painters to traverse the landscape and paint messages on rocks and, you know, quarry walls and mountainsides. And I mean, it would be, you know, if you talk about the visual cacophony of advertisements that you might see today in Times Square or in Tokyo or downtown Los Angeles at LA Live, this is the kind of visually assaulting space that a person was encountering in the 19th century. And so as advertising evolves over time, one of the other through lines that I trace in the book is how the media evolve over time and how it becomes more visually centered. And I start with newspapers. And one of the interesting things that I found in newspapers and in surveying 1830 to 1900 is I expected to find the innovations happening first in the cities, because I think that's a reasonable assumption to make. We tend to think of New York, particularly in the 20th century, as the center of the advertising industry. And certainly the earliest advertising professionals who were writing their own histories, that's happening in the 1890s, they're writing their own histories, they're positioning themselves at the center of innovation, and they're saying it's all in New York, the big cities, this is where it's at. But that was actually false. And I really only discovered it by accident. I happened to have a research assistant at Misericordia, shout out to Elisa, who was from the local area, and I had tasked her with finding newspapers and pulling samples, a sort of sample set for me, from newspapers in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Vermont, and North Carolina, because I wanted a counterpoint to the data I had collected from the New York Times, the New York Tribune, the New York Herald, and big city papers. She happened to pull a range of samples from the Wyoming County Democrat in Tunkhannock. And I was struck by the level of innovation and flexibility that was showing up in these, you know, what we would call rural newspapers, even though Tunkhannock was the county seat, not really rural, but certainly not urban in the New York sense. And it took some time to investigate and figure out why this was the case. But the short of it was that the big city papers had all sort of made an agreement that they were going to adhere to this very small 5.5-point type. I call it Agate. It's called Agate font. And they would institute strict rules and ban images from advertising. And they did this in the mid-1840s. And so from the 1840s onward, you see these very boring advertising sections in the big city papers. And it was common, not just in New York, but Chicago, Philadelphia, D.C., London. The London Times is one of the last newspapers to rip itself away from the Agate rule. But in places like Tunkhannock, the editor was much more interested and willing to allow images and bold fonts and creative shapes in the text where they form the text itself into diamonds or cascading margins down the side, or they use white space where they might buy an entire column of text but only have like 10 words. It's like if you're typing on your computer and you put in one word and then you hit enter 8 times, right? And then the next one comes in and then another 8 times. So they're taking up an entire column with not very many words. And they use different kinds of fonts, like not Wingdings, but, you know, they're using Times New Roman, they're using Agate, they're using italics, they're using these fun woodcut prints that look like old English. They're using scripted fonts. And, you know, if you think about going through your Word menu today and you can look at all the samples of fonts, imagine choosing 10 or 12 of those to put in your ad. And then they started using images. And they started putting it small images of products, but sometimes they would put funny little pictures in there or little, there's one I think that's in the, towards the end of chapter 3 in the book, there's like a long swirly dragon snake thing that encapsulates, it just sort of forms a border around the whole ad, and the ad takes up an eighth of the newspaper page in the corner. And so these editors, who were also the printers of the newspapers, they were making choices. And someone asked me recently, why? You know, why were they aware of what was going on in the city? Why were they doing this? And I think, you know, part of it is demand and knowing your clients. They've got local clients, people with retail stores or sales agents that they're working with in their communities who know them. And they might be saying, Harvey, I'm not going to give you my business if you don't let me do these wacky images. Or I saw Jim had these crazy things in his advertisement last week. I want something like that. And so whereas the big city papers, they have people knocking on the door to get the ads in. And so they can turn people away left and right for no reason, you know, because they just want to adhere to the rules. And so I think a lot of it comes down to those community relationships. But it was super interesting for me to see this influence coming from the outside in, rather from the center, New York City, out. It's coming from the outside in, so that the big innovations are happening in, like, Tunkhannock. And so when we think about community relations and how do you build a rapport with people who you're never going to meet face-to-face, and how do you convince consumers to buy your product through print, you have to convince them that you're trustworthy, that the product is good and valuable, and that it's going to be worth their time and money, that they're not going to lose out, they're not going to be swindled in some way. And so how do you do that? You entice them with information. You give them evidence, right? You might make reasoned arguments. You try to show them your character by showing them you're a reputable person, using appropriate language, showing your education, showing that you consult with or convene with other smart, trustworthy people. So you list endorsements from folks like doctors or the mayor of Philadelphia, you know, which one medicine manufacturer did have as a signatory, judges, local magistrates, newspaper editors. Anyone who was a prominent member of the community could be a testimonial writer. That was another way. But they also found ways to entertain, to create memorable stories, to use those spokes characters like the Quaker Oatman or the Franco-American Soup Boy or Phoebe Snow, who we know so well in this region, right? To use those characters to create a story that consumers would come back to, that they would want to know, what's going to happen to Phoebe Snow in the next installment? Will she marry that suitor? I don't know, right? Will her dress get dirty? I don't know, right? And so there's a sort of entertainment function that comes into play right around the 1870s, where advertisers are figuring out that people find images really appealing, that there are ways they can use the images to entice consumers to look at advertisements more, to kind of look away from the commercial message and instead look at the image that is drawing them in.
Talk to us a little bit about the role of graphic artists.
Yeah, graphic art really began with the printers. It was the printers first in the early 19th century, and I have to note that I I take a lot of my knowledge of the history of graphic design and the role of printers from several wonderful scholars, but one of whom is David Jury, who wrote a really interesting and lovely book to read. I mean, it's just a beautiful book. It's called Graphic Design Before Designers, I think. And it came out several years ago. But one of the things that I demonstrate in my work is that many of these innovations came from printers. And it was because printers were the experimenters. They were the ones who were tasked with taking the advertising message from the person who wants to place the advertisement. So the retail store owner, the manufacturer, the factory owner, whatever. They're taking that information and they are translating it into print media for the newspaper or for the poster or for the handbill, the flyer, whatever. Or later trade cards, which is another topic and later in the book, these little handheld advertisements. And so they're experimenting, and through decades of experimentation, they're starting to figure out what's working and what doesn't work. And they realize that big, bold fonts catch the reader's eye, and they're constantly looking for innovative ways to draw in the reader. They're competing. You start to see the advertisements competing on the page with each other in the newspaper page, where you might have one successful tactic for a line of shirts, for example, that works one week, but then the next week there's a big bold image for medicine and like the whole bottle might appear in the column. And so this shirt advertisement gets overweighed by the bigger and brighter and louder competing image. And I think it's really the printers. And when I say printers, I mean engravers, I mean the publishers, the ones who are carving woodblock prints. They're really the ones on the ground tackling these problems of how to communicate with the public and how to draw in the reader's eye. And as their craft develops over time and these innovations come from disparate points in the network, incrementally, by the time you get to the 1890s and the advertising agencies are getting bigger and they're starting to incorporate illustrators and graduates of new technical schools and business schools and people who have been trained as artists or illustrators or industrial illustrators, sometimes they're called, or commercial artists, and they're incorporating them into art departments within the agency so that the printer's role, which had been a position of authority, really the expert to consult with the client and tell them what's going to work and what doesn't, that role's being displaced by the end of the 19th century in favor of these new in-house art departments, the creatives in the big agencies. And that's the beginnings of what we will later see in Mad Men when Don Draper is sitting around the table with the other creatives and they're showing images of whatever product they're trying to advertise and they're looking at different taglines and different fonts and texts and images. And let's say we're going to take this one and smack it with that one. And all of that is happening in a new way by the mid-20th century. But it's the act of creating starts with the printers.
Now, we have a chance to see a lot of these images. Tell us about this exhibit.
Yes. So I'm very excited to also promote the exhibit that is currently on view at Misericordia University. It's called The Mark, Graphic Design and Consumer Culture Since 1800. And it will be on view until May 11th, so just before Mother's Day. And this is an exhibit that I co-curated with my very good friend and colleague and conspirator, Dr. Lelaine Little, who is the director of the Pauli Friedman Art Gallery at Misericordia. And so one of the really fun things about working on this exhibit is Lane had approached me about doing something related to my research and my book. And I said, well, you know, there's actually some really cool local examples that I think we could get. And so we were able to get several pages from the Wyoming County Democrat, from the Wyoming County Historical Society. And I was so thrilled when I first made a visit up there and I saw that they were in pristine condition. And so I have to thank the past librarians and archivists who saved these materials so that we could now put them on display. So we've got materials from Wyoming County. We've got materials from the Luzerne County Historical Society, from the Hagley Museum and Library, which is part of the DuPont Estate in Delaware, the Winterthur Museum and Library, which is another DuPont-related house museum down in Delaware as well, the Anthracite Heritage Museum in Eckley Miners Village, and the Railroad Museum of Pennsylvania. So we're thrilled to have all of these wonderful lenders coming together in this exhibit. And the exhibit traces this evolution of graphic design, as I've mentioned, from the earliest newspapers and printers' innovations through trade cards and these funny little pictures of children, and then the spokes characters like the Nabisco Slicker Boy, the Morton Salt Girl. And we even have a section on local trademarks where we talk about Mr. Peanut. Fun fact, Planters Peanuts was established in Wilkes-Barre. So we talk about Mr. Peanut and Stegmeyer. And so we have a wonderful display also of a shop. We've tried to recreate a sort of circa 1900 dry goods store where we have cases of display. And there's some really large, wonderful photographs. And I hope I'm not overselling it in that it would be an immersive experience. But yes, I'm very proud of this and encourage everyone to come out and see it.
You are proud of your work and of the exhibition, but you're also humble, and you didn't mention that you'll be offering an author's talk.
Yes, I'm giving a talk on the book and a guided tour. Of course, I'm available for tours outside of this, but on Thursday, April 25th at 5:30, we will have a book signing and a guided tour with myself and Dr. Little of the exhibit. And as I said, we're also happy to talk to special groups or give other tours upon request.
Dr. Jennifer Black, who is an associate professor of history and government at Misericordia University in Dallas, just outside Wilkes-Barre, speaking about her new study titled Branding Trust, Advertising and Trademarks in 19th Century America, issued by the University of Pennsylvania Press. Dr. Black will present an author's talk with a book signing this Thursday, April 25th, at 5:30 p.m. at the Pauli Friedman Art Gallery on the Misericordia campus, where an exhibition titled The Mark, Graphic Design and Consumer Culture Since 1800, will be on display through May 11th. Branding Trust, Advertising and Trademarks in 19th Century America, issued by the University of Pennsylvania Press. And we heard about the study in connection with an exhibit at the Pauli Friedman Art Gallery at Misericordia University in Dallas, Pennsylvania, just outside Wilkes-Barre. Mark, Graphic Design and Consumer Culture Since 1800, on display through May 11th, with a book signing and author's talk this Thursday, April 25th, at 5:30 p.m. For more information on the web, misericordia.edu/art, misericordia.edu/art. The events are free and open to the public, and light refreshments will be served. And that's this Thursday afternoon at 5:30.